from runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the weekly internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Carl Franklin introducing show number 10 with guest Isaac Roy Bell, recorded Wednesday, June 6th, 2007 at TechEd in Orlando, Florida. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, offering professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
Hi, you're listening to Run As Radio, and this is your host, Richard Campbell, and with me always, Greg Hughes.
Hello, Richard. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I'm shaking off TechEd, though. Boy, oh boy, that was a long week.
It was. It was fun, though. Boy, I'll tell you, I sure got to see an awful lot of cool stuff, meet some really cool people, you being one of them.
Yeah, we'd never met before. That was the first time we were face-to-face, was there in the fishbowl at Virtual TechEd.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I had a great time hanging out with you and Carl, and like I said, there was just a lot of very interesting people that are doing some really cool technology stuff right now.
Did you get a chance to go over into the vendor space and see some of the booths?
I did. Boy, there's a lot of really neat stuff coming up. I know that there's one organization that you're somewhat involved with.
Oh, Strange Loop?
Yeah, Strange Loop and the appliance and accelerating ASP.NET web applications. I got a chance to talk to the architect there.
Kent.
Yep, Kent, a really smart guy. Another one of those, as we say, scary smart kind of guys.
Yeah,
right?
Kent has that sort of Einsteinian, the hair too, right? So it's sort of all over, and he's brilliant. And we had him up on some panels for .NET Rocks to talk about scaling ASP.NET, him and Rob Howard and a few other real serious ASP.NET guys.
Right, yeah. But, well, what a great idea that Strange Loop Appliance is. That's just really cool. And, all the .NET Rocks recordings that were going on, the panels, and Speaker Idol, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Speaker Idol was pretty crazy. Everyone seemed to like it. I think we'll have to do that again at TechEd.
For sure. That was really popular. People were talking about it all over the place.
Well, we had a good time. No rest, though. It was a very, very busy week, and I think I maybe slept 4 hours a night, because you can't miss the parties. If you're going to go to TechEd, you got to go to the party. And then I was up early every morning to do the next thing at the virtual TechEd stage.
And it was some great parties, too. You know, the Islands of Adventure Universal.
Oh, the attendee party.
Oh, my gosh. They closed the place down. Microsoft rented the entire place, including free beer and free food. And the entire park, roller coasters, water rides, and everything was open to the 15,000 attendees of TechEd for the entire night. It was just incredible.
Off the hook. And the year before when we did TechEd in Boston, we had Fenway Park. The attendee party at TechEd is always off the hook. It's a remarkable show and an awful lot of fun.
And that's the first TechEd that I've had the opportunity to actually go to. It seems like every year I've had a conflict. And so I was really pleased to be able to go, really glad to be able to meet you and a bunch of other people. One of the people that we met was Isaac Roybal.
Yes, you found Isaac, actually, as I recall. You know, our goal when we were at TechEd was to pick up four shows, was to find four, probably Microsoft people, but anybody interesting in the IT space to get some material for Run As Radio and get an opportunity to see the future things. And that's the great thing about being at TechEd. Everybody's there. And we talked to Isaac about IIS 7, all the management features. And funny thing, we actually took this interview twice.
That's right. Yeah, the first time we had a little microphone problem.
Well, yeah, I left the phantom power switched off on the microphone and didn't notice we had no signal. So we recorded a nice half hour blank air.
Details, right?
But Isaac was good enough to come back and talk to us again. We got a great interview from him.
Yeah, we sure did. You know, and IIS 7 being one of many components of Windows Server 2008, which I personally find to be pretty darn interesting and in a couple of cases, pretty darn exciting. I think a lot of the problems that I know I have had and people that I work with have had with previous versions of IIS are really pretty well dealt with in IIS 7. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to the interview. Well, here we are at TechEd, and we're talking to Isaac Roybal, and Greg just happened to flash his card at perfect time. Hi, Greg.
How you doing?
So we're now it's Wednesday night at TechEd, and we're at hump day. This is sort of the burn day where only the serious can keep going on. So, Isaac, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I've been at Microsoft for about 5.5 years now, and I'm the product manager for Windows Server with the what we call the web workload. So essentially anything involved with the web that has to do with Windows Server, that's my responsibility. So and obviously IIS is a big part of that.
IIS 7 is probably a big part of what
you're
focused on. IIS
7 is what I dream about nowadays. I can recite it in my sleep almost, yeah.
So I thought IIS 6 was perfect.
Well, IIS 6 was a really good platform. I mean, we did a really good job compared to our past versions of 5 and 4. We really made some big security changes going forward, but we really we still lacked in some areas, right? And one of those big areas was manageability.
Sure.
So we did a lot of work in IIS 7 to really address those issues.
So maybe can you dive a little bit into that? Tell us at a high level, give us an introduction to what's better in IIS 7.
Okay. Well, you know, IIS 7 is huge. I mean, it's a big change, but it's not such a change that you're going to have to relearn everything, right? We took all the goodness from IIS 6 and added onto it and addressed some of the pain points that we had in IIS 6. So some of those changes are around the manageability piece, like I said. So we have a completely new UI. We have a managed code interface that you can now write scripts, etc., to it, and it's compatible with PowerShell. We also have an appcommand.exe, it's a command line tool called appcommand.exe, and we also have a new WMI provider that's a lot cleaner. So now it's really whatever type of administrator wants to, or whatever his choice is, he can now use any one of those mechanisms. So the new UI, if you love the user interface, if you're a command
line. That's still MMC?
Basically it's MMC, but it's a WinForms application, essentially. So it's fully extendable to the fact that you, if we provided you a piece of functionality that met your needs, but you want to change it a little bit, you have that ability through that managed code API that I just talked about a moment ago.
Right. So that, what did it used to be called? Internet Service Manager?
Yes.
That was the main UI, and mm-hmm. you could also pretty much access all of that from the MMC as well.
Correct. Correct.
So those pieces are still there, but they're new and improved.
And they're rearranged.
Right.
So now.
And customizable.
Exactly. So in the past, you had to go and you wanted to change a property, for example, on a website. You had to go down to properties and do advanced settings, and you had a bunch of tabs that you had to look at. So what we did is we actually broke out all those tabs and put it in a what we call a task pane now.
Right.
So it's just a flat look whenever you click on a node. Now you see all the tasks that are available for that particular node. So we break them up into, say, application development, health and diagnostics, security settings. Maybe you want to manage just your FTP settings. So they're all just point and click and right.
So
right
easy
there.
To find. None
Very
of the,
easy.
None of the old school IIS. Right click and try to find the menu and drill down multiple layers to try to find the one thing that you do most often.
Absolutely correct. So now they're easy to find right there.
I always right-click, go to properties, and then keep clicking the tabs till you find the thing you were looking
exactly.
for.
Exactly. So it kind of felt like you were tripping over your shoelaces a little bit trying to get something that wasn't very efficient, right? So now that was one of the major things that we looked at in IIS 7. How do we help administrators save time? Their time is very valuable. I was an IT pro for 10 years, and I hated when I had to stay late to troubleshoot issues and fix things and try to manage my servers.
Right.
And it was a very cumbersome process, and we really spent a lot of time to address those issues.
Troubleshooting in IIS has always been, for lack of a better term, a real pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what have you done for us in terms of our ability to be able to troubleshoot problems related to IIS?
Well, that's a great point. IIS 6, you know, you had some tough times. So what we've done is actually have what we call detailed error messaging in IIS 7. So in the past, you would just get a 400 error, maybe a 401.1, for example.
Right.
But, you know, what does that really mean? What's going on under the hood there? You had to troubleshoot your server, you know, all these different ways. Then you would try to get a piece of information out, go to TechNet or MSDN or go to any kind of news group and try to figure out what's going on.
Right.
Well, now with the detailed error messaging, not only do we give you the subcodes, so we have 401.1 or 401.14, but we also break it down by category. So we tell you specifically the area that's having an issue. So let's say, for example, ASP.NET. You have an ASP.NET setting that could be wrong.
Right.
Our error code will tell you that. And it'll also tell you, here's most likely the cause of the problem.
Okay.
Then it'll also give you, here's some suggestions on how to fix your problem.
That's kind of mom-like.
Exactly. Almost like, that's a good analogy. It's almost mom-like. So it gives you some guidance as to, hey, here's the area that you should look at. Here's probably the cause, and here's how you can fix it.
And mom meaning Microsoft Operations Manager.
Or Systems
Operations Manager. But if it's going to be mom-like, then we're not talking about your mom.
Yeah, not moms in that way.
We're talking about your mom.
So also another thing that we did was we noticed, and I've been in these shoes many a times, where you get a user who says, my page is loading slow. Or I get a 500 error every once in a while, but you can't repro the situation, right? You can't repro the error.
Works good on my machine.
Yeah, works good on mine. The developer says, hey, it works great in my development environment. You know, it's always user error.
Right, those are some of the most frustrating ones, most difficult ones to track down and troubleshoot.
Exactly, because it's really, you know, searching for the needle in the haystack. You know, that's the true sense of the word there. So what we've done is we've actually created what we call failed request tracing. Sometimes it's referred to as FREB. It's kind of the internal code word within the product team.
So far we have your mom and Fred.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. So with failed request tracing, what you can actually do now is you can set a condition for your server to watch for. So now let's take the scenario we had a few moments ago. Your user says, my page is loading slow. So what you can do is actually on individual websites within IIS, you can now set a criteria of what kind of content to look at. So you can do all content. Maybe it's an ASP.NET page. Maybe it's even a PHP page. You can actually get that criteria down. Then you can set a trigger on top of that. So you could say, for all content on this web server, if you run into a 500 error, start logging and see what's happening.
So this applies web page, could be a web service. It's not actually serving up UI pages, but the same rules apply.
Correct. Correct.
So anything that a 500 error is really generated by IIS in context of one of the applications like ASP.NET running.
Correct.
And so you turn on logging. What does that actually mean?
So when you turn on the logging piece or the failed request tracing, it actually, it's almost a, we make the joke of it, we wanted to hire Ron Popeil, right? The set it and forget it guy, right?
Okay.
So you go on your server and now you can set it and forget it. So now you have a trace rule that sits there and watches for you when the repro happens.
Right.
So you don't have to spend hours, days, even sometimes weeks trying to repro this situation.
So what can I do with that information? How do
so
I
once
use
that,
it?
Yeah, that's a great point. So once you get the information out, we had a repro. What it does is it spits out a log file, and it's actually an XML file that's loaded with XML style sheets. So now you can go and double-click on these logs, and you can see them in this very clear, precise, formatted XML document that tells you anything that was happening in the request pipeline and actually at what particular point it failed. So let's take the example of my page is taking too long to load. Well, maybe a developer wrote a bad ISAPI handler, for example, right? Or a bad ISAPI filter. So as it's coming through and stepping through that process, it says, I loaded this ISAPI filter on and now my page started to spin. It was taking a while, and you can see the amount of time that it took to do each step within that pipeline.
Gotcha, right.
And you can obviously narrow it down very quickly, and now you can say it's definitely a development issue, kick it over to your developers and make them debug their code.
Well, and you've also got the parameter list that it was running under, so you know they can reproduce the situation.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. So what you can do now, not only does it tell you the status code of what happened, so say it was taking some time to load, it was slow, but it actually returned to 200. So it says, hey, I got a 200 back, so I got the page. But also tells you what user they're authenticating as,
right?
What handles were being...
All that sort of context information.
All the context
that's
information.
That's probably what's different between production environment and the dev environment.
Absolutely. And you can say what app pool it was running under, even the process ID that it was loaded in at that particular moment.
What about ASP.NET in a scenario like that? Not that ASP.NET pages are ever slow, but just imagine for a moment that might happen. Because, you can call it an ISAPI filter, but it's so much more than that.
Sure,
but
sure.
How does this FREB behave with that?
So actually what you can do now is once you set your rule that I spoke about a few moments ago, so we said the type of content that we wanted to look for, the trigger that we wanted to happen, now we can also have providers that we want to have error or logging happen against. So we actually have an ASP.NET provider that gives you all the detailed information of anything that was loaded that was related to .NET. Or ASP.NET for that matter, right? So it actually drills in and it tells you, here was this particular module that was called for ASP.NET and it's causing some sort of error, for example, or it's, you know, giving us a time to load. It's just kind of spinning there. So it really allows you to refine regardless of what the content is.
Well, that's good. I mean, I think from a manageability standpoint, thinking about it from the standpoint of the guy that's running the IT department or working in the IT department, there's real value in being able to say, all right, that's in code, I can kick it over to the development staff, as opposed to having to troubleshoot something that they may not have any real impact over.
Absolutely. And you have really, the proof is in the pudding, right? So you can say, I know absolutely it's a code issue, instead of the developer saying, no, it's a user issue. Right. So you can really have that evidence. So there's, you become troubleshooting CSI kind of thing, right?
Not dealing so much with the abstract problem, but really dealing with the detailed nuts and bolts, which
absolutely
is really good.
And it also saves you time, right? So you don't have to spend days, weeks, you know, sometimes even months, who knows?
Well, and I can imagine you don't have to remember to turn that on. You don't have to wait for the error to happen once and then switch it on and hope for the error to happen again. It's going to get it on the first error.
Exactly.
But unlike most logging systems, I'm worried about the overhead, right? I mean, generally, if I'm just leaving logging on all the time, I can't deal with the log sizes. What kind of load am I going to be have exerted on me when these 500s pop up for the logging?
Well, that's a good point. Actually, whenever you do enable logging, there is a small amount of overhead, but it's something that we kept in mind. So we know you will see a little bit of overhead happen because it's watching all these requests that are coming through, but it's not significant to the fact that it'll impact it. And it's only on a per-site basis. So it will not affect server performance in any way. So if you're having one site that's acting funny and doing some crazy things, you can enable failed request tracing on that particular site, and it won't affect others.
And presumably you have fewer 500s than 200s.
Correct.
We at least got to hope anyway.
Correct. So you don't want to absolutely, you know, do all content, you know, all error codes or success codes for that matter,
right,
and you'll just be logging like crazy. So it's allowing you to refine that troubleshooting so you don't have to have these big, bulky log files to dig through.
Right, especially 500 being an exceptional case. You want to minimize the number of exceptional cases and probably properly log things if you do have errors that are application errors that would be
correct,
more appropriate to handle differently.
Exactly.
So it sounds like what you're saying is this is an XML file with a style sheet on top of it, so I can view it in a nice, pretty way, but I could also use that structured data and leverage that programmatically if I wanted to.
Correct. If you have some other third-party tools, maybe that you have a log parsing tool, like Log Parser, that the IIS team came out with,
it's
just flat XML as well that a style sheet is put onto, so you can feed those files in and spit it out in any kind of log format.
Well, I can also see sending those files to PSS as well if I can't crack it.
Good call. And actually, that's a good point. And there was a gentleman that came to our booth today that had this issue that was going on. We explained to him how FREB, or failed request tracing, would solve his problem, and he could also take this data if he could not absolutely prove what was going on, package it up and send it over to PSS as well. So
right,
it's exactly the same thing.
I think I know that Greg's pain is all about the diagnostics with the developers, but we talked about some other management pieces as well. I know I talked to you about the MMC a bit, but you mentioned two other bits, PowerShell, and what was the new one? It's App Manager?
So we have appcommand.exe. And essentially, think about this. So I'm an old command line guy, right? I started in DOS 6.2.2. I love to bang away at that keyboard. But in IIS 6, or 4 and 5 for that matter, we didn't have a lot of command line tools. We had a few, but they weren't really that good. And the one command that was used extensively was IIS reset, right? So what we did is we looked at all the things that that administrator would do on a common basis, you know, really querying the status of a website. Maybe want to change some port bindings or change the ID, maybe list all the requests that are coming through the pipeline at a certain moment.
Right.
And you can do all of this right out of the command line with appcommand.exe. So the way you can really think about this particular tool is it's an equivalent to the UI, but on the command line. Now, there is some things that you can do in the UI that you cannot do in an app command, obviously, but I would say probably 80% of the functionality is there on the command line that's in there in the UI as well.
So I'm thinking about the things I'd want to do with this, and either way, I'm thinking about stuff like deployment, that I could have an entire script to set up a virtual web, configure permissions, set some rules around what the app pool is, all of that good stuff. That's all done from there?
Yes, you can do it in there. And say, for example, if there's a piece of functionality that you want to do that you cannot do in app command,
right. You
can also use the WMI provider or the managed code API that we have, and you can use them in tandem if you want. Say you have a batch file that goes off and kicks off a process to do all this provisioning, and there's a small piece that doesn't get done, then you can call a VBS script, run some WMI, or even a PowerShell script that'll get that done for you.
Yeah, of course, I thought about PowerShell about this. Why would I need app command instead of PowerShell? Couldn't PowerShell do it all?
It could, but there's the older guys who just, you know, maybe they're not coders per se, right? They don't really understand the syntax of coding.
Right. And this is much more batch file-like.
Exactly. So it's more of the batch.
Hence this DOS 6.2.2 reference.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Very command-oriented.
Very command-oriented.
As opposed to scripting-oriented.
Exactly. You get the slashes and the switches and the question marks to find out what's going on, and you can drill down in that.
So one of the big pains, if you will, in terms of doing large-scale deployments of IIS in the past that I know I've had to deal with has to do with large server farms.
Mm-hmm.
And a consistent deployment across multiple farms, multiple virtual web servers per physical host.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done anything for us in that area to try to improve just the manageability and the usability of IIS from an administrative level?
Absolutely.
For the farm.
We thought about that specific scenario, and we also thought about it in the hosting scenario, right? So we've got a lot of hosters where you have 1,000 sites on one box, and the box goes down. You need to get your customers back up quickly and easily. So what we did is we took a major step, and we got rid of a little thing called the metabase. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that and have heard about that.
Oh, thank God.
So
that's not going to be missed.
I don't think so. We did not commission a tombstone for it or anything. It's just going to be buried in some undisclosed location.
I think we should have a ceremony.
Yeah. Gone the way of Clippy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So it's over in the closet with Clippy that we have locked and sealed. So what we've done is actually moved away from the metabase and moved to a .config file format. So it's still XML, but it's very flexible and customizable.
Okay.
So now with the metabase, it was key to a machine. Now it's not. So you can actually have a flat file copy from one server to another. So let's take the example of the hoster. He has 1,000 sites on one box, all saved in this what's called the application host.config.
Right.
So that's the main server file that saves all the server settings. Then per each individual site, we have a web config, which stores sites and settings to that particular website.
Okay.
Well, if a server goes down, now we can actually copy those files over to a new server, and we're back up and running as if we were on the same exact server. So we have no SIDs that are tied in keyed in the metabase, for example, in IIS6.
Right, and of course that was always a struggle with dealing with the metabase. So I mean, web config, everybody loves it. Mm-hmm. It's all XML, and you're saying the app config is essentially the same file format, same style,
exactly the same.
If you like this, you'll like that.
Yep, and it's so easy and flexible that you can actually create a website directly out of the application host.config file. So you can take a snippet. Copy a certain website.
Copy and paste it.
Copy and paste it. Change a few of the individual settings like the ID and the port bindings, and you have a live website.
Create new app pools at the same time?
Yes, you can also do the same thing.
So mm-hmm. Add new virtual sites, change existing virtual servers?
Sure, everything is written. Anything you do in the UI is written to this file. So it's exactly the same thing. Right. It's that flexible.
I change the file.
Mm-hmm.
And, in the past, at least, if I make a change to something and I have to do an IIS reset to get this thing to come back up and take the new settings, is that still true?
That is not the case anymore. So before, you had to take down the entire server or the service, per se, and reboot it all. So everybody says, okay, we got our new settings and let's chug forward.
Yeah,
the great IIS restart.
Yes.
Which was my primary diagnostic tool, I might point out.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't
restart
know what's going
first,
on,
ask questions later.
Exactly.
But of course, that means all my sessions are tanked.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a lot of love when you do IIS restarts.
That's correct. So now, if we make a change to a specific app pool, for example, say we have 40 app pools, right? We make a change to one. Well, that individual app pool is the only one that gets restarted to get its new config.
So, in the past, app pools, true isolation of app pools was sort of not a real thing.
That's a very good point. So, actually, you could have two different, going back to the hosting example, you have 1,000 servers or 1,000 sites on one server. Those guys could kind of sneak into each other's app pools if they knew how to do it.
Right. From a security perspective, there was a little bit of a gap there.
Exactly. So we solved that. We knew there was a problem there. So what we did is we actually have app pool isolation and sandboxing by default. Okay. So when you create a new site, a new app pool is created for that site, and we have a temporary config file specific for that app pool, and it has a SID for that app pool to that temporary config file. So only that app pool can read out of that particular config file.
So it's like a one-time config.
Exactly. And then once that app pool is stopped, that file is destroyed. And then next time it's started, we have a new one and it's keyed up to it.
It occurs to me one of the things that's happened in the progression of IIS is we've gotten more and more and more isolation. Because IIS 6 is the one that really introduced the concept of the separate app pool.
Exactly.
But it had some leakiness.
Yep.
And so now you've isolated that further. And you go further back, there was a time when any website crashes on your IIS
box
and all
of
IIS is gone.
Screwed. Yep. Yeah, you're just
exactly.
Gone.
So And really, we got a lot of feedback from the hosting side of our customers to say, hey, if I have one website that goes down, it crashes my entire box, I'm losing 999 other customers here. That cannot happen. So that's actually where the app pool idea kind of spun off of. And then we're improving it in IIS 7 to say now we're making it more secure.
Right.
And the analogy we always use in the product team is that now it's to the point where you can run Coke's secret formula on site one and Pepsi's secret formula on site two, and they can't sneak
they
into
can't
each other's.
And ne'er the two shall meet.
Exactly.
And I really like the idea that all of this stuff's now config files. So we talked about how app command can set up a new virtual web, but all it's ultimately doing is writing this app config file.
Exactly.
So our application host configuration.
Yes, applicationhost.config. Yep.
Yeah, .config is all that ultimately creates. So if you feel like typing those files out by hand, if you're a Notepad genius, you can set up a virtual directory.
Absolutely. And
could create them programmatically on the fly. I'm thinking you could set up a system potentially to actually batch automatically create new servers on the fly.
And actually, here's something that, if an administrator so choose to, he could call our managed code API, write, say, a tool in C#, give it a UI, plug in all his settings, and it'll actually churn these things out by calling our API. And he can create these application host.configs however he chooses to.
So I'll take it another step further. We've talked about, okay, now I can take my template, if you will, config file. I can drop it on a whole bunch of different servers, and I can be consistent. But what if I just want to be able to maintain one template in one place so I can make all my changes in one place and have that flow consistently across servers?
Well, that's a good point. Actually, we got some good feedback around that from customers, especially in large web farms, right? So in IIS 6, you had to have one metabase. You had to configure that, replicate it to server 2, 3, and 4,
right?
And then if you made a change on server 1, you had to replicate it again.
Right, which is pretty clunky, to be honest with you.
Very clunky.
Fraught with peril.
Yes.
The number of times I battled one machine is configured differently from the rest in a web farm.
Absolutely, and then you get one
agonizing
bad apple in that bushel there, and it ruins everything, right?
Yeah.
So what we came up with was a feature called shared configuration. And what shared configuration does essentially is we have, say, one master server, or maybe even a test server, right, that we configure up with all our settings for both our server and maybe our application and our site itself.
Okay.
What we can do is actually export that particular configuration to, say, a back-end UNC share. So we have a file share in the back-end. We drop this file in there. We can enable shared config either through the UI or we can script this as well. And it'll enable shared configuration across the entire front end. So now servers 1 through 5 are all pointing to this one back end file, and they're all sharing that configuration.
So you keep the configuration in sync because there is only one file.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, aren't we got a risk of single point of failure at this point? What happens if that UNC goes away?
Well, that's a great point. We get asked that question a lot. So this is a new beta 3 feature, okay, that we just implemented. So obviously there's still some work that we have to do on that to make sure that it fails elegantly if that share ever does. But one thing that is built into Longhorn Server now, or Windows Server 2008, is client-side caching. So what you can do is have a cached copy of that application host.config on each server. Just in case that UNC share goes down, it can pick up a local copy. And it doesn't necessarily damage the server. Only when changes are submitted does it need to read to that file.
And
the
only way to submit changes is to have that UNC share up in the first place. So
correct.
The big thing is if that server went down, the web server should just continue to function on their last configuration.
Absolutely, because it's loaded up in memory.
Yeah, nothing else to do.
Exactly.
It's only when you want to change it that you notice, hey, the share has died because I can't get to it to change it.
Absolutely.
And now I'll go fix it.
And there's some other guidance behind that and some other things you can do, like maybe deploy Microsoft clustering services in the back end for that file share, right? You have one node to go goes down, you pick up another one,
right.
Or maybe you can have some network load balancing or a hardware load balancing device that can spread that load to different machines. So obviously some steps we can do there or that the customer can do there, and we're also looking at other ways to solve this issue in a more elegant way.
All right, so here's another one for you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you got, if anything, is what about just user accounts on IIS, and what about being able to distribute the ability to manage certain parts of IIS? So here's, you know, a use case might be I have a team of developers or an entire division of developers, and I need to be able to allow them access to do certain control over IIS, but maybe not the entire thing.
Yep. So in the past, what we had to do, you look at IIS6, you know, I like to compare and contrast here because a lot of people really can see the benefit here. So in the past, you had a relationship of an administrator or a server. It's always this one-to-one relationship, right? And IIS was integrated into the operating system. And typically, if a developer needed to make changes on that IIS server, you had to give them full admin rights, local or domain admin rights.
Yeah, you were either administrator or you weren't.
Exactly.
There was really nothing in between.
Exactly. So you got all or nothing, right? So that's where we really kept looking at this and said, no, we need an easier way for administrators to be able to do this. Okay, it's adding overhead. We're not saving them time, right? So what we did in IIS 7 was we created this new IIS user. And what an IIS user is, it's not a Windows security principle in any ways. It's just exclusive to IIS. So it only sees IIS, and IIS only sees it.
So it's not a domain account.
It is not
a
domain
account.
Nope, not in any way. It's just exclusive to IIS. So now we kind of pulled a little bit back out of the OS and said, now we have IIS users.
Okay.
And now what we can also do is give, say, for example, we have our developer Joe. We can add Joe as a local IIS user, okay, just exclusive to IIS, and delegate administration rights to a site or even the application. But they cannot connect to the server node. Only administrators can do that. So so myself as an administrator, I can still manage my server from a global level, and now I can delegate administration rights or site owner rights to individual users, whether they be IIS users, and we also still allow Windows users.
So role-based authority inside of IIS.
Absolutely. Role-based authority.
That's pretty terrific.
So now we can also use global groups to delegate those administration rights or even Windows local groups, for example.
Okay.
So we can do those things as well.
What account privileges does that IIS user operate under when it needs to communicate out to the server?
So that's actually a great question. So in the past, we had a couple different ways you had to ACLE down a content, for example, with an NT user,
right?
Well, what this specific management service, it's actually a web service if you want to think about it. So when you remote in, you actually are connecting to a web service on IIS, okay? But how does that now correlate to the operating system? How do I access files? So I'm a developer. I need to make changes to my site, and it's written to the web config file, right? Because remember, all our sites are stored in a web config. However, I don't have NTFS permissions to write to that file, so I'll get an access denied error. So what you actually have to do is give the service itself access to modify that file.
Okay.
So then essentially what you're doing is delegating access to the OS on a very granular level only to a service. So you don't have to deal with passwords anymore as well.
Interesting. So it sounds like we're talking about some new APIs on top of IIS. Now, the whole concept of public and private APIs, what's the story with IIS 7 in terms of where all do I have access? You've mentioned a couple.
Yeah, so I mentioned
the
big thing is I've mentioned the managed code API that we have, Microsoft.web.administration, right?
Right.
Well, guess what? In the past, we had our own IIS API that we wrote to, and then we had a public API, so the SAPI extensions, right? So we kind of looked at it and said, why is that happening? We need to have some more fidelity between the customers' implementations and our implementations. So guess what? We said everything we're going to write against IIS is going to be to the same API that our customers write to. So everything that we write is written towards Microsoft.web.administration, and now our customers can load up that same API and write code against it as well.
What amuses me about that solution is it's actually less code for you and a better solution.
Absolutely. So we can say, again, we looked at what can we do to save time for the customer, and we said we don't know their environment the best. They know their environment the best. So what we can do is provide them these core fundamental building blocks and a platform in the truest sense of the word and allow them to build what maybe we didn't include in our product, and they can build it for their specific environment.
So, .NET framework versions, classic ASP, what's being supported?
Everything. Everything's still backwards compatible. So when we really looked at it, we said we want to save guys time, right? We want to save admins time when they go out and administer these boxes, but we also don't want to make them reinvent the wheel. So they obviously have a lot of past investments, and they spend a lot of time writing scripts, hosting other types of, say, even ASP, classic ASP. All of that's still supported, and we also made improvements in PHP support.
So it must be some kind of meta-based to config file migrator there to take an existing site and move it across to IIS 7.
So actually what we have is called the ADO mapper, and it's a particular piece of code that sits there. It's like a translator. So an administrator wouldn't actually see this piece of code, but when they try to run an ADSI script, for example, the ADSI script is fed through the ADO mapper, and that ADO mapper says, well, this used to be in the metabase in this particular spot.
Right.
Well, I'm going to translate this, and I'm going to store it in the web config or the application host.config file, because that's where it goes. That's the best equivalent.
Is it a one-time deal, or it does it each time?
It does it each time. So it's just continuously. It's a translator for any type of script that you have, ADSI script that you have. So it gives it that backwards compatibility.
Now, in the keynote here at TechEd a couple days ago, they dropped a bit of a friendly bomb, if you will, I suppose, because they were talking about the Windows Server 2008 core, right? Core server capabilities, which is basically a almost user interface-less version of Windows 2008. But they announced that IIS 7 would be a part of that core offering.
Correct.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And one of the things that's come up recently, just to ask the tough question, is what about ASP.NET? Because it sounds like ASP.NET actually will not be one of the capabilities of IIS 7 in the core deployment.
That's absolutely correct, and that's currently, right? So it's not really a question of if it's going to be supported, but when it will be supported. So currently, with the .NET framework and the way it was implemented, it doesn't work very well with server core, so it was removed out of there.
Right.
Well, obviously, ASP.NET relies on that. Well, now with IIS included in server core, that gives administrators greater flexibility for, say, static content. So they just want a little web server that just sits there, does a specific task over and over, and they don't want to really have dynamic content.
Sure.
However, you can still write native modules to this particular web server. So you can crack open your C# book or your C++ book and start coding to that as well. And it also does PHP support for dynamic content.
One other thought, and I was just thinking about the IIS user, because it actually reminds me of SQL Server with its sort of mixed mode. You have SQL Server accounts as well as domain accounts.
Great analogy.
Yep. Yeah. But one of the issues you ran into, why we kept getting told in SQL Server, stop using mixed mode, just use domain accounts, is security around those accounts. So what about the passwords? You said it's stored in a web config file?
So no, actually we have a third file that is called administration.config, where these particular usernames are stored along with their passwords. However, the passwords are completely hashed, so they're not readable or plain text in any way.
And that's going to work okay in my my personal environment, but I got to think for an ISP, that file's a bit of a nightmare.
Correct. So what we've done is we actually thought about that scenario as well.
Yeah, I mean, the online banking environment that I have to worry about, I could see where that could be a serious problem.
Exactly. So now maybe you want to store all these passwords, username and passwords, in a back-end database. Well, with the extensibility options of IIS 7, what you can do is actually create a new authentication provider for these IIS users to point to your back-end database. And within that database, say, for example, you have your passwords hashed and protected there.
So forms-based authentication or what have you.
A great example, yes. Forms-based authentication is stored in a back-end server.
So if I have an existing application and I want to do authentication against my database that my application already has with usernames and accounts, you're saying that I can basically, maybe not quite this simple, but point IIS 7 over there and say, use that as the credentials to authenticate the users as they're coming into the web application.
That's absolutely correct. You can do exactly that.
It sounds like something an ISP would need.
Absolutely. Yep.
A thousand websites on that group of servers, and you want to be able to allow them each to administer themselves, do some development-level work as well, but restricted to their accounts, and you just don't want that written to a text file. You might need that managed something a little bit faster, more robust, and easier to back up.
Exactly.
But not to mention performance-wise, if you're dealing with a million accounts, you know, on an online banking site, then, you know, not only is there a security issue potentially with having hashed passwords, but plain text usernames sitting in a file and, you know, acquiring that, but just load a million lines of users of a file, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make any sense at all. So you can do individual queries back and forth whenever you only have to make a call for one user.
So, Isaac, we're about out of time. Mm-hmm. When am I going to get IIS 7?
Well, it's available right now in Beta 3, so go ahead and go down. You can go to Microsoft.com.
So that's part of Windows Server 2008 Beta 3?
Exactly. So you can pull that down. It's also available in your Vista builds, so I know everyone is purchase Vista, in case you haven't. It's already in there, so you should go out and get a copy so you can start playing with IIS.
Now, there's a new site, too, right? IIS.net.
Correct. We have a brand new community site, so that's one thing that we really want to emphasize with IIS 7 is this is a community project in a way, right? So what we really did is we're putting that foundation forward, and we're saying now it's up to you guys, whatever you want to build on top of that, you can come to this community site and you can talk about these things. You can actually say, I have a module. I built a module to solve a problem that maybe somebody else might have. Right. And it's almost you can say, hey, come to my site and I'll give it to you. I'll hand it over. So it's kind of a redirection site to be able to do that. We also have an extensive news group section there, so everyone can kind of jump on there and chat and say, hey, I got these problems, or I want to develop this kind of module. What's the best way to do that? And actually, a really big benefit of that is the product group hangs out on there all the time. So you can get actual advice from the product group themselves. So the product unit manager, his name is Bill Staples. He's constantly on there answering questions and responding on those forums.
Nothing better than hearing from the guys who wrote the project in the first place.
Absolutely.
Isaac, thanks so much for your time. Really looking forward to seeing IIS 7 out in the field.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, and we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.